Look at that. Oh, we're here.
I should be looking at there. I should be looking at you.
I'll look here, you look there.
Got it. Welcome back. This is the second major chunk. I don't know if it's a day, if it's an evening, or what, or what time it is. Again, we're in a room with no windows. Okay. But we are here for the 417 upgrading your skills to Server 2012 Jumpstart. Wow. The comments and the questions from yesterday is going on endlessly about all sorts of stuff. So I'm glad you're enjoying
this.
Well,
we just finished the last question about 5 minutes ago.
I know. So if you're asking questions in the room, thank you. And if you're answering questions in the room, even thank you more. But we will be getting to your questions as soon as we absolutely can. And we are checking in on them to see what's going on. But this is the Jumpstart. My name is Rick Claus.
And I'm Ed Lieberman.
And he's Ed. We don't even have the slides up right now, so you can't even see the fact that I have
Whoa,
the slides.
Look at that.
There you go. There's Rick.
There's Rick.
There's Ed.
There's Ed. Enough said.
We are talking about the jump starts for 417. And our expectations is just a quick review from yesterday. Again, the jump start concept is that it's fast-paced. It's real-world explanations. And actually, someone came up with a question about this. They're saying, you know, is this on the exam? I don't understand why the guy's talking about real-world stuff. And it comes down to... it's how you apply your knowledge. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even our real-world anecdotes, you know, hopefully we'll try to, you know, stimulate or something inside your head that's going to make you think about your real-world experiences to be able to use them when you are writing the exam.
Well, plus the exams are experience-based exams. So theoretically, it's off of real-world anyway.
Yeah. So we're assuming that you have some experience working with Windows Server. Specifically, oh, look, there's a bill site, even though it was a building. you're curious about technology and you want to learn more, this is the one I was looking for. You have to have the ability to walk in and say that you've already worked with and have been working with Server 2008, Server 2008 R2. In theory, this course, which is really the equivalent of 15 days of training crammed into 5 days, which is really crammed into 2 days for this particular session, worth of knowledge that we're going on. So you have to have some background.
Rick, I'm sorry, I have to interrupt you.
What, man?
We already have our first technical question of the day.
Yeah?
And he wants to know if we need IPv6 for direct access.
No.
I'm sorry, refer to yesterday's session on direct access.
Yes.
Do you want to answer that one?
The technical question?
Yeah.
Well, Jeff already answered it. He yelled out no.
Yes. For a simple implementation or a quick install, you're able to get away with having translation technologies take effect.
I don't think you really needed to answer. There was a smiley face.
Okay, smiley. Okay, good. Good. I don't want to get started on this one here. Anyway, you flip back the slides for 1 second. Assume knowledge. You've used and installed Server 2012 in some capacity. You've hopefully done your research and homework to find out what's going to be on the exam by going to the Microsoft Certification website to see what's on the 417. As I mentioned, it's like 15 days of training crammed into 5. We're cramming into 2, so we're just touching on some points. You have experience with PowerShell. You have experience with DNS, Active Directory, stuff like that. Virtualization experience is actually interesting because this morning's sessions, or the next 3 sessions we're talking about right now, is going to be around clustering, high availability, and virtualization. The afternoon sessions are going to be around dynamic
something
access.
Else.
Something else. Dynamic access, Active Directory, and
federation thing.
Yeah, the federation thing as well. So it's a 5-day... I should know
15-day into a 5-day into a 2-day.
I think I've said that enough. Let's move on here. So
and
there's the
go.
Modules.
This is where we're at.
So I'm actually going to kick this off with implementing failover clustering.
I'll see you in a little bit.
You got it. No. Right. We did nap yesterday.
Yeah, okay.
No,
I'm not taking a nap. I'm good to go.
There's no nap. And in case we are highly caffeinated.
Yeah.
Well. It's early in the morning for us.
I'm naturally.
Naturally caffeinated?
Caffeinated, yes.
You got it.
Anyone who knows me.
In this module, we're going to be talking about failover clustering, how to implement a failover cluster, configuring highly available applications on failover cluster, how to maintain it, and implementing multi-sites. And kind of sum this kind of up. In case you don't know, you can do all this clustering work without having access to a massively expensive SAN of some kind, without having access to storage with fiber channel, sort of stuff, because you can use the free inbox server iSCSI target software to host shared disks that are locally attached to a machine up into the network. And then you can have guest systems, or either physical or virtual, that attach up to that with the initiator to be able to make your shared disk, which is the requirement for being able to make a cluster. So you can even use your own technology, and we're actually going to be doing this virtualized on a box to be able to have this up and working.
We hope.
It's
all good. It's all good.
To be able to get going on this. So the first kind of general topic that might come up is around availability and what it actually is. And the reason why is because if you ask anybody, who is a business owner, who owns an application, who owns a project or something like that inside your organization. You say, hey, you know that project that you're working on, I need to have these kind of systems to be able to make it work. Do you want to have that highly available and available all the time? Their automatic answer is yes. And then you're going to say, okay, well, how much downtime can I have? And they're going to say,
none.
You got it. Which is physically impossible to have, or at least extremely expensive. I mean, even if you just go with, there's a Wikipedia article, there's a website you can go to that lists off the number of hours, days, and minutes, and seconds downtime you can have when you start off with a 99%, 99.9, 99.99 gets extremely difficult. 99.999 is next to impossible. And, you know, the more nines you go, the more complex and redundant and expensive it is to be able to implement it.
So no downtime is impossible?
I'm not going to be the one that says that it is possible, because that would be stupid to say.
Okay.
You know, that's like, what was that? No, I can't.
Never say never?
Well, never say that something's unbreakable, because right. More than likely, I'm going to break it.
Yep.
So, highly available services that are available.
You're the 1%.
Generally, I'm the 1%.
Okay.
Generally, they're highly available about 99% of the time. In case you're wondering, 99% of the time, I believe, works out to 3.5 and change days of planned downtime or unexpected downtime.
Per year.
And then if you read your service level agreements, and this comes up because of like web services and online services you're subscribing to, or your hosting services you're subscribing to, they have a service level agreement, or an SLA, that talks about how many minutes of maintenance windows they have, how many downtime days they happen to have, how much notification they have to give you. Sometimes, even if you're talking about like a rolling window of like a four-month period, like a quarter period that goes through, that's even less than 3.5 days of downtime. It can go down to hours and down to minutes. And so, generally, you have to have some level of high availability. That's going to be talking about clustering. That's going to be talking about architecture designs for what you're going to be doing to be able to get that level of stuff. But typically, planned outages are supposedly not included when you're calculating availability. However, if you go and talk to that business owner about that project, they count it. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't, they do.
Anything bigger than none.
You got it. Anything bigger than none. So failover clustering improvements, that's in there with Server 2012. Because that's, again, really the difference is clustering's been around for a while. I mean, I remember the days of Wolfpack, my friend, back in NT4. Clustering's come a long way since then. And mainly in 2012, some of the improvements are there. It comes down to the scalability aspect, again, because the operating system can now support much larger drives, much larger physical drives, much more amount of RAM that's available. You got some improvements to the cluster shared volumes, or CSVs. Cluster shared volumes, we'll talk about what they are coming up in a little while, and what you would use them for different levels of applications. Predominantly things like Hyper-V or SQL servers and stuff like that. Clusterware updating is a new thing that I'm actually going to be able to show you, because I've got a live cluster in the back I'm going to be talking to. It's on the physical hardware. And you know what? I actually went through an update last night. And it was great watching my 12 machines that are on there. They're on two different nodes. And I say, go ahead and do the update. And it goes in and handles moving the workload off, doing the download, doing the application of all the stuff, and then moving the workload back on again, moving the next guy, coming back again. So very, very cool stuff. Active Directory integration improvements as well for what clustering can now do. The dependency in Active Directory domain controllers has not been eliminated. It's been slightly reduced, if you will. And also some management improvements. One of the things you might want to be aware of, though, this is more for a situational type of environment, is the fact that the command line tool, cluster.exe, really is kind of deprecated, not depreciated, it's deprecated, mm-hmm. In the sense that...
It's word of the week.
It's the word of the week. It basically is now removed, mainly because it's no longer required. You can now do this stuff in the GUI interface or through PowerShell anyway. So... something to be aware of, that the cluster.exe file no longer really required at this point in time. Architecturally, when we start talking about failover cluster components, you could literally spend hours talking about how to design your storage infrastructure, your SAN infrastructure, and everything else to make your cluster work. And this is where either if you don't have the experience, some good reading is going to help you out, or this is where if you're doing contracting and hiring individual professional services, they're going to have the expertise of being able to make this work. Talk to your storage vendors. Clustering is going to rely on having highly available storage that you will be going off and accessing. You can replace it, if you will, from a learning perspective, and even inside a lab and technically even in a production environment, you could use iSCSI Target on Server 2012 if you wanted to. It's highly available. You can use it. Mm-hmm. As long as you architect it to be able to support what you're looking for. Or you're going to be using a shared bus with shared SAS, or you're going to be using a fiber channel or something like that to have access to those drives in the sky, if you will. You're going to want to have at least a couple of network connections into those shared drives, mainly for redundancy purposes. And you're going to have dedicated networks that are going to be used also for failover between those clusters. So one for the nodes, node 1 through node 2, 3, 4, all the way up to 64. And then you have accessing the storage. And then you're going to have another shared network between them that is used just for the failover process back and forth between them for traffic. And the way you optimize that is simply designating which connection points in the binding order are going to be used for storage, which ones are going to be connected up through and used for the different migration purposes, and then finally, on the public side, which ones are available for the public to go off and to use and consume those apps.
Hey, Rick, do you have any specific, you know, specific feedback as far as the different types of storage, advantages, disadvantages, or would you say that every scenario just kind of plays itself differently?
You know, I'm going to say the depends answer for that.
Well,
If I was to do this for the sole purpose of me to practice and understand clustering because I don't have access to storage and I'm trying to pass an exam, I'm using iSCSI Target. It's free. It's in there. I showed you how to make an iSCSI Target with some initiators. It works fine. I'll show you the steps for that one there again coming up. If I was designing a cluster, the problem is that the technology release cycle, everybody leapfrogs over the other one as far as performance goes. And so you've got, you know, right now, iSCSI is in vogue because of the new technologies, 10 gig E, Mellanox controllers, InfiniBand controllers that can get like upwards of, you know, 40 or 50 or 60 gigabytes per second transfer rates. If you architect your storage around that kind of networking infrastructure, the disk that's available, fantastic, great sort of stuff. It's not as complex as HBAs and Fiber Channel. That's kind of like a black art, if you will, in my opinion, for managing storage and how that works. But it's obviously different technology for, you know, some people say Fiber Channel, it's hard to hack into a beam of light compared to hacking into packets that are flying past using iSCSI protocols. Your mileage may vary. You pick what you have. Generally, if people already have a SAN implementation, they're comfortable with it, they use it. They become, you know, advocates of their particular technology, and that's what they use. Other people, it's like Greenfield, they don't have a SAN right now. You know, cost-effective-wise, iSCSI is potentially going to be cheaper unless you architect it and just blow it up and make it huge with, like, you know, six multipath switches and six different controllers, stuff like that.
It's pretty much like everything else. It's a matter of looking at simplicity along with cost, along with security, and seeing what's available and go
from
there.
Your needs. I mean, does it meet your needs?
Right.
If it's purposely built to simply learn about the technology so you can talk about it and you can architect it, you design it, use the stuff that can be in box if you don't have access to the real stuff. If you have access to the real stuff and it's not being used because it's the old SAN that was replaced and you got a new SAN being managed by other people, maybe you can upgrade your skills on that side. So
cool.
That's a deflection kind of answer.
That's okay.
I guess, eh?
No, I got what I needed. Now I can go set up my cluster.
You got it. Now, the one thing that's kind of interesting is the whole concept of clustering. The basic premise is you've got an application workload running on node number 1 or running on node number 2, and there is an issue where you need to move the instance of that workload over from 1 into 2, where it's a planned failover or where it is a reactive failover because there's something that's gone wrong with one of the nodes, like the hard drive fails or whatever it happens to be. During a failover process, all the instances running on that particular node are moved to the other node. Now, based on what that workload happens to be, there may or may not be a brief interruption in service or maybe a delay. I mean, if it's transactional-based, you're probably not even going to notice. It's going to be kind of like a slowdown. If it's actually open files, and there may be a drop and a reconnect that has to happen. But a failover is going to occur basically when the node that currently hosts that workload becomes inactive, unresponsive, whatever it is, or the administrator forces that failover that comes there. You can then go in and identify in the cluster configuration for those workloads, do they fail over and stay over there, or does the node simply fail them back again to the original node when it's back up and working again? So you can configure what those different options are. You can even identify preferences to say failover to this guy if it's a multi-node cluster. One of the changes I forgot to mention at the very beginning, but I think we talk about it later, is simply with 2012, one of the big changes is the number and sheer scale number of nodes you can have in a cluster. In 2008 R2, it was 16. 2012, it is 64 nodes.
You're already forecasting in 2020.
You got it. It's the
1,000 years from now. 20,000 years from now.
I will have even less hair, and the hat will still be green when that one comes out. You can have up to 64 nodes in a cluster. Now, these networks that we were talking about earlier, generally, that you know, there's naming conventions you can use that you basically adopt your own style to remember what they are. The big thing is that you have to do the legwork of identifying what those networks are, what type of traffic is going to be going across them, and then you keeping it straight which adapter is plugged into which one. The biggest cause of error in these days in data centers is user error of plugging the wrong cables in or switching the network traffic to be different nodes, and also if you're the user and admin. If I'm the user, for sure.
You're the user, yes.
So generally speaking, you've got the public network where the clients are going to use to connect up to the service. You've got the private network where there are nodes that are going to be communicating with each other for purposes of cluster heartbeat and transfer of data. And then there's also the private and public network between the systems that are required for accessing of the storage between those different nodes. So these are simply some loose definitions that you should kind of keep your head around when you're defining which network cards are plugged into which physical switches. And again, try to eliminate single point of failure. If you have two network cards, team them. If you have the ability to have multipath through two different switches to talk to the same storage, use those two different switches. So you eliminate a single point of failure to increase your chances of having that high availability. So with cluster storage, you need to have some kind of a shared storage that both nodes have access to. That's typically going to be either a iSCSI target that you're going to be accessing. That could be on a server 2012 box. That could be in a third-party iSCSI SAN. It could be a fiber channel where you actually got HBAs talking to the light network, the fiber network, going off talking to your drives and then to your endpoint. And finally, it also could be shared SAS or SSAS for access to your shared drives. That's what that happens to be on there. Quorum comes up. They've been around for a while, and it defines basically how does the cluster technology know when all the nodes are healthy? And basically, you have to ensure that you have enough cluster members are available to provide your services. So quorum is basically on 2008 is based on votes for how many that are there, and you basically have to ensure that you have enough nodes that are alive with their vote to basically say that the cluster happens to be alive and working and stay online. The difference is now you don't necessarily need to have a dedicated quorum drive anymore. You now can simply have a quorum drive or a file share being used or individual nodes being used and then choose a majority factor to say, hey, as long as I have more than half of my votes in and alive, then I know my cluster's up and working. If I go below that, then I know my cluster's down. I got some issues that are going on with it. So if you take a look here, we've got the no majority basically. Only the nodes themselves have a vote, and you can do that when you have three or more nodes inside your cluster.
Do you have to be registered to vote?
No, you can actually, as long as you have a green card, you're good to go. Can you vote with a green card or a citizenship?
I don't think you have to be a
citizen. I know I can't vote.
Yeah, you can't vote.
I can't vote.
Thank goodness that you can't vote.
I know I can't vote. But anyway, that would be, you know, that I would be the quorum disk in the election. Because
okay.
I wouldn't be used in the first one because only nodes can vote. The quorum is maintained when more than half of the nodes are online. That only works if you have three or more. Node and disk majority. I hit the button. I'm sorry. That is where
you're
you happen
excited?
To have the node used as a vote, basically, as well as a witness disk or a file share being used. That one there happens to be available. Quorum is maintained when half of the votes are available and online. Node and file share majority, same kind of concept. And then simply no majority, where it's disk only. That is simply where the disk is the vote, and that's the only one that says, can you talk to everybody, and they're all good. So this is really a simple process to set this up based on the number of nodes you plan on having and then how you want to make sure things are happy, things are live during the initialization of what that guy looks like. Now,
So I have a question for you.
Yeah, sure.
What are clustered shared volumes?
You're transitioning to the next slide for me? You're good.
It's early.
CSVs, clustered shared volumes. It's a type of storage that you can go and initialize with Server 2012 that basically eliminates the need to dedicate LUNs from your SAN over and into your environment. A problem that can happen is basically you have only so many LUNs in your SAN environment, and if you identify that you have so many shared resources of groupings of pools exposed to your service as LUNs, you can possibly end up running out with your SAN. CSVs, you don't have to worry about that. It's more efficient use of disk space because you basically can have the ability for the cluster shared volume and the volumes that are on it to expand and contract as required, provided you have drive space. Other thing is that all the resources are in a single logical location. When I make a clustered shared volume, it actually shows up on the nodes as C:\\volumes, volume 1, volume 2. And then that way you always know when you reference your infrastructure of your shared machines, like I'm going to copy a machine into my clustered shared volume, I always know it goes in the same spot and I can always find it, which is always good. No special hardware required. It's fantastic. It's easy. I'll be making a cluster shared volume coming up here in the demo in a momento. Planning for failover clustering. Basically, if you want high availability, clustering's your friend. You want to use it. Potentially, scalability isn't required. That's simply a matter of you have dedicated active-passive. One guy's available there in case you want to have it. You could have it where it's active-active, where basically both nodes are using and working with that workload, in which case you do have scale capabilities. Client app automatically reconnect on the application when there's a problem, and it's using basic IP-based protocols for the application to talk to it, like, you know, SQL queries, web server, file share, whatever it happens to be. That is your implementation of failover clustering.
Which obviously makes it a lot simpler than what we've had to deal with, you know, generations ago.
Yes. Oh, yes. Very, very much so. The neat thing I like about this is for clustering is that you're not tied into a particular vendor or particular setup and configuration like you are with some other solutions. You literally can use any component that says the certified for Microsoft for Windows Server 2012 logo requirements. You can use it as part of a cluster. The server nodes basically should all have the same configuration. I mean, you got to make sure that they have similar components installed on them, similar roles installed on them. You don't go off and have dissimilar configurations. Generally, the same type of hardware should be used on a cluster, definitely the same architecture. And the big thing is this whole validation wizard. 2008 R2 brought out the cluster validation wizard, and if you call up Microsoft support looking for help with your cluster, the first thing they're going to ask you is, can you send me a copy of the validation wizard results? Because that shows the 170, 150, 180 odd tests that it checks on to say, is your cluster valid and have we checked all the possible things, as opposed to having to go off and do these things manually. So we had some cluster issues earlier on before we started this jumpstart, and I talked to my buddy Simon Perriman, who's clustering guru, and I said, dude, can you check out this cluster? I don't think it's working correctly for me. And the first thing he said was, can you send me the cluster validation report? And I'm like, no. He's like, why? He's like, because I didn't build a cluster. You just log on and get it. So it's like, oops.
Yeah.
I should have known better and got a copy of it off the server and sent it to him. I made him do the work to be able to go off it.
It's a regular thing with you.
You got it, man. On the networking side, it has to also basically be certified network drivers that are on there, obviously. It's going to be connected up to multiple networks. And that whole concept of this redundancy comes in again from an architecture. You can redundantly architect your solution to the point where it almost gets ridiculous, but it comes down to your budget for what you have to put into it. How many cards off the back of the server that can connect up into a network? How many switches can you connect up into independently to be able to talk into your storage, that sort of stuff? And possibly using redundant hardware, NIC teaming, and others to remove a single point of failure. Label, document, label is all I can say. To remember which NIC on the back of the machine is called what, how are you going to refer to it, and then what cables are plugged into what to make sure people don't go off and change them for you. And obviously, this goes without saying, your network adapters should be using the same versions, the same speeds, the same duplexes, the same flow control capabilities. You can mix and match your NICs. Generally, you're going to want to keep them all the same so that you have a consistent experience across them. But at least make sure that they have similar speeds. You don't want to be mixing in 1 gig with 10 gig connections in your servers for different things. So make sure you've got those same kind of offloads.
I like using 10 megabit.
10 megabits?
Yeah.
Why don't you dig out the ARPANET or something, dude? Go for Token Ring. Do they even make Token Ring drivers anymore?
I'm still on the ARPANET.
Nice.
The kids
with your green screen.
The kids these days are talking about the internet. I don't
those crazy kids. Get off my lawn. Requirements for your failover cluster. Obviously, you have to have DNS name resolution.
I just can't throw you, can I?
You can't. I'm trying to stay solid, man.
All right.
All servers in the cluster have to be the same Active Directory domain. So basically, it uses domain authentication to be able to identify, is that cluster someone I can talk to? Am I going to have issues talking to it with Kerberos and sort of stuff? User accounts to create the cluster have to obviously have administrative rights on all the servers that are being part of the individual node install. And you need to go off and be able to create computer account objects within the domain, because you're going to be making a new instance of manageability for that cluster. Failover cluster infrastructure recommendation also includes the fact that, again, each role that is on node number one should also be in node number two, node number three, node number four. Ideally, the minimal number of roles possible, because this is a cluster. It should be doing just that, just the clustering. Let the guests, if you're doing virtualization, do all the work. Don't actually have stuff installed, like also a file server and also a domain controller. Just stay away from that, man. Don't go there. Software requirements. This is kind of interesting, because this is where I found some typos in the slides. It actually was saying that you had to be, for instance, Windows Server 2012 Enterprise. It doesn't exist. It's a typo.
But weren't there like 14 versions yesterday?
Only standard.
And none were Enterprise?
Only standard. Only data center are the two you got to worry about. Standard and data center have the same capabilities. The only restriction is on licensing. So they can handle clustering. They can handle 4 terabytes of RAM. They can handle so many hundreds of logical processes that are on the system, and sort of stuff. So it's Server 2012 standard, Server 2012 data center. One thing you do need to be aware of is also that the server implementation, you need to have them either all full GUI or all server core. You can't mix and match them between them.
Really?
Yeah. That's a little interesting thing. And also, same thing with the processor architecture. It only exists in 64-bit. There is no 32-bit, and there's no more Itanium support.
I believe we saw that yesterday as well.
Yeah, so I actually caught this one. I didn't catch the top one. I did a strikeout across the bottom. All nodes, same revision of patches, updates, and fixes. So, enough
MO.
Talk. Let me show you this cluster validation.
Why don't you show them how this works?
I should probably show them something.
Yeah, show them something.
Let me show them something.
All right, come on, show them something.
So, where am I at here? I'll save that guy there.
You're in this room without windows.
I know,
that's
I'm working on this, man.
It's like Vegas in here.
I know they're not pumping in oxygen in this room.
So you're this pumping is carbon dioxide.
Yeah, so that's what that tailpipe smell is.
That's monoxide.
This is actually the cluster administrator, or failover clustering management snap-in that's running on my system for failover cluster manager. And this is actually looking at the hardware that was provided to me by the file server team before this jumpstart was started. So this is actually looking at this new architecture. It's called Cluster in a Box, which I'll talk about a little bit later on. Cluster in a Box, in quick form, is literally a 2U or a 4U sized rack mount, is the current version of it. Fully independent cluster in a box, as opposed to having a common backplane like you would have in a blade system. It literally is a full node number one and node number two with independent power supplies that are using shared SAS, as an example, over networking, connections into an array of drives in the front. And you literally have independence where either one of those nodes have full access to all 12 of those drives, or they have access to carved up versions of those drives. And you can literally pull one of those nodes out and pull the other node out, and it still is all fine to be able to work. So I'll talk more about cluster in a box, where it's coming in and how that works. But right now, this cluster is already up and running. So this is the one where I had my buddy Simon go and take a look at it. All I needed to do was come over here and say view validation report, and then save this file and email it to him, because this basically shows off what's going on. Now, obviously, these exclamation mark warning signs, mm-hmm. they're literally just warnings. So, for instance, they're warning me that, for instance, there's some quorum configuration issues. If I want to get more details on something, for instance, here, Hyper-V integration services. It actually couldn't go in and query the existing workloads on that cluster because all these machines were turned off at the time. So that's why it came back. So this report is basically hyperlinked to be able to look at different things. If you want to go off and take a look at networking issues, click on networking, and then specifically it's here with IP configuration. It lists off my IP adapters, my Mellanox controllers, my gigabit backplane controllers, that sort of stuff. But it's simply complaining here, if I scroll down to the bottom.
Faster.
We're getting there. It's big. There we go. Simply warning me that some of the adapters do not have, either have addresses on the same subnet, and if I look down at the bottom, that address right there, that's the auto-configure address, which basically means, hey, they're plugged in, but they're on a network that's not being used by anything, and you haven't hard-coded an address or not using DHCP, you should probably fix that. Mm-hmm. That's because I'm not using them. I'm literally just, they're there, they're plugged in, they're not being used. I already have my storage network defined and my public network defined. So,
right.
Again, this is some information here. So this cluster got the clean bill of health despite the warnings from my buddy Simon, so that's good.
And just to be clear, warnings similar to what we see in other areas of server as well, means you have a potential problem, but it will not prevent it from working.
Right.
You'll see an error.
Yeah.
Or does it show up error or critical? Or
if there's a critical error, it'll show up big red bang.
Big red
stop
X,
sign.
Right?
Those ones mean it's unsupported. You got to go fix it.
Yep.
And that should be clear enough for you to figure out why there's something wrong. Now, again, in the past, you didn't have this cluster validation wizard and the results that came out of it before 2008R2. And it's the same wizard that runs some slightly different parameters that are being checked, but very, very good stuff inside that. And if you needed to, you can always go in and say, rerun or validate the cluster if I wanted to be able to have that guy run again. I'm not going to bother running again because I want to go off and actually make a cluster because this takes a while to run, and then I'm going to talk about how to make a cluster. So let me basically kick off my cooking class demo.
We'll spend 10 minutes looking at a progress bar. Go ahead, kick it off.
So, okay, I need to connect.
It's always fun in the morning. First thing in the morning, look at a progress bar.
You got it. I need to sign in here to number 3 and to number 4. These are going to be my two cluster nodes. So, of course, they're just waking up like
they are.
Are
they running?
Yeah, they're running. Okay. They're coming. They're coming, man. Okay. I hope I reset them. That's the bigger question. If I reset them or not.
Well, if not, the demo will be really fast.
You got it.
Look, it's done.
Okay. Let me go in full screen here to get rid of this title bar. Okay, so this is server number 3. I have gone ahead and installed the file server, the clustering feature.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a role, it's a feature.
Okay.
To speed up the demo, because it takes about 5-10 minutes to be able to go off and simply install that feature. So basically, if I type in fail, I can bring up the cluster manager.
I thought it was going to say Rick Claus, actually.
You just got the zingers today, buddy, don't you? I want to say go ahead and create the cluster, because there is currently no cluster inside my environment. Wizard interface, you can click for more details. Don't show this again. Hit next. And here it's going to go in and validate what my cluster name happens to be for my nodes. And this is LONSVR3 is the first node. It's going to go off and contact that, and that's basically in the background doing checks to say, do you have admin rights? Can I resolve the name? Is it available to be used? This is the second guy, checking to say the same thing, do I have admin rights? Is it available to be used? Is it in the same domain? So it's doing those background checks. If they don't get into here, they don't pass those background checks. Next up, it says you need to be able to select for the cluster. Reports from cluster configuration validation test appear to be missing because I haven't made them yet. Do you want to run the validator test before continuing? Absolutely, yes. So here's the validation wizard. Comes up and runs. Here's my local administrator. Run all my tests. And here's all the possible tests that are going to be going on. And this is going to take about 10-15 minutes to finish off. So I'm just going to let you look at this run. And then we're going to flip back to the slides and talk about this in just a minute and come back and the cluster is going to be made. That's how simple it is, man. In the background, what I've created, let me actually show you just one last little thing over here, is I can show you this on number 4. Let me sign on to number 4. Of course, it's a little slow because it's doing background checks on it. Here we go, back in the full screen. What I just wanted to show you was I have, from a disk configuration perspective, I have 3 volumes, 3 disks that are attached using iSCSI initiator targets as my source for my clustered shared disk. For my shared disk that's going to be used for my cluster. I set that up ahead of time, again, because you guys didn't want to see that go through from a timing perspective. So I'll let that guy continue and then go from there. So let me flip back the slides. Any quick cues in there? Any questions that we need to worry about?
No, I was just going to comment, though, how, you know, speaking of the context of how we were talking about 15 days into 5 and then now into 2, isn't it amazing the advancements that have been made with clustering? Used to be, originally, the first clustering class I ever did was a 10-day to learn Windows clustering.
I used to make a lot of money as a consultant validating clusters, and they replaced me with a wizard. That was before I joined Microsoft. Let's flip back to the slides here. Identifying cluster resources and services. Clustered services basically are apps that are made highly available. So, like, for instance, you can cluster DHCP if you wanted to. or other different types of services. Resources are basically components that make up clustered services. You can move them back and forth to know when one node fails. Basically, that's your thing that you're making highly available. It's either it's a resource you're making available, or it's a service or an application you're making available on your different system. So I've gone ahead and already installed the failover cluster feature from add remove roles from Server Manager. I actually did it from Server 3 and managed both systems remotely.
Features.
It's a feature. It's not
it's
a role.
It's a feature.
Verify the configuration and create the clusters going on right now in the background. Installing the role on all the clustered nodes using Server Manager. So
install what role?
The role that you want to make highly available.
That's right. So just to clarify, because we keep emphasizing right. This is a feature. We're not talking about the clustering role. We're talking about whatever role it is that you want to.
So I'm making a cluster now. I'm actually, the role that I'm going to make highly available is a file share or file server.
Okay.
So I've already also installed the file server role, but I haven't configured it at all. I'm going to be adding that in after the fact. Configure your application and make sure it's up and working. Go ahead and then do a test of the failover to make sure it's still functioning.
We have to test?
You have to test and then retest and then test again to make sure it's good.
Okay.
So let's see if I can get this.
See if your demo
see
is
if my
done
demo
with
done,
the progress
or if I've got
bar,
some
right?
more witty conversation we have to have to basically fill some time.
Did you say more witty conversation?
More.
Have we had any?
No, not
okay.
yet. We haven't gotten that yet. Take a look here. I'm about 3/4 done and still progressing along.
So
if you
need to come up with witty conversation.
This is actually, believe it or not, if this wasn't a compressed course, it's actually interesting to watch all the tests that's going on. It's entertaining to watch how fast this scrolls, which tests go through. Tests are all passed. In this case, I've got a network of network issue once again, but it's simply a matter of doing it. And look, perfect timing.
See, a moment ago, it was 99%. I was going to ask you if it was highly available.
The big thing is testing was completed successfully. It appears to be suitable for clustering. That is my go-ahead.
Appears to be.
That is my go-ahead.
Appears in all caps?
However, you should review the report because it may contain valuable information. So let's take a look. Really, it comes down to all green except for under networking.
Just hold that button.
I don't, I'm getting there. I don't want to. This guy right here has a warning. Valid network communication. That's all. So knowing from experience and working in this way, where's my networking? Come on. View the report.
Oh, there's another one.
Oh, there's also a memory dump settings. Basically, the amount of RAM allocated is too small or something like that. So if I wanted to, I can click on network, take a look at the report under network communications, and again, it's simply warning me that I only have one pair of network interfaces. Probably you should have more of them to get more networking paths, to get more levels of redundancy that's in there. The other one was on system config. Under memory dump settings was simply warning me that it's... debug info type on node blah is 0. It should be set to either 1, 2, or 7. So basically the default memory, you want it to do a full memory dump when there's a problem, in which case I should set it to say, give me the full one, which is a 1, give me just the kernel debug, which is small, or you decide, as opposed to give me nothing. It's a VM. I don't care. This is just for me going up and doing this. So he's all done. He is created. Now it says, okay, I need you to create a cluster name. This is what you'll be actually attaching up to in the management console to be able to appear as using that clustered resource. I'm going to use the highly identifiable cluster 1 as the name. And I'm going to give this, 135 for the address.
I certainly understand what that is.
Because I could have gone to my IPAM implementation and found out what addresses were available. Mm. But I'm just doing this quick because it's a demo. Remember, it's 135.
And with that statement, I have 12 IPAM questions. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Hit next to say it's all done. It makes the computer account object inside my Active Directory. That's why I have to at least create object rights inside my AD to make sure it's all working.
How much witty conversation do we have to have for this bar?
Almost done, man.
Almost done. It looks like about 10%.
We can have the awkward silence if you want.
Or we can listen to you gulp some water.
This is driving our producer crazy right now. I just wanted to put it on.
I was actually waiting for the producer to just go ahead
start throwing
and start
throwing stuff.
No, I was waiting
yelling
for him to start making noise to get rid of the silence.
There you go. The cluster has been created. Yay! It's done. And because I want to try to fit this all in, this cluster has been created. It is now done. It is happy. I can take a look at my nodes, my roles that are already installed. Currently, there are none. My nodes that are running, I've got node 1 and node 2. Both of them happen to be up and be happy. Storage-wise, I can see that I've got two storage disks that are attached, three of them. One is being used as the quorum because I only have two nodes. I have to have a quorum disk to give me my third to give me enough votes. And then I have particular events I can take a look at. So let's go ahead and configure a new role on my cluster. And I want to say let's make a new highly available file share, which is a file server setup. Hit next. I want to say this one is either going to be for a general use or is for application data or scale out. Scale out is something that is used for things like virtual machines or server applications like SQL that need to have the ability to add and remove node resources onto it to be able to do it. That's basically your scale out application data file share. In this case, I'm going to be using just the regular general use file share for sharing documents that are open and closed. So this is basically your highly available SMB3. This one over here is your general use. I'm just going to keep it with general use to keep it simple. I'm going to call this ADATUM file server share. And I'm going to be using the IP address of 136 because it's one up from 135 that I used. Again, just picking the number out of the air.
I always like 243.
That. You got it.
I need to use that one next time?
243?
Yes.
I like actually 200. I don't know why.
No, because that's used all the time. 243 is that one that no one ever uses.
Okay. I'll use 243 next time just for you, buddy.
Okay, thank you.
Make the shared disk, make it available, hit next to be able to go ahead and create it. And now on 136, I have my new ADATUMFS file server availability that happens to be there. And he's now good to go. How do I manage and work with this? Well, believe it or not, there's this lovely thing called Server Manager.
What's that?
It's this tool. I think you should review it and know it because it's quite useful. And under all servers, the neat thing about this is because it knows that it is a node in a... I want to get rid of this guy here. He's legacy. Remove him. Because he is a legacy system, he's I was from my lab last night that I was playing around with. This guy here is up and running. He's good to go. That is the guy basically is my cluster interface that I'll be attaching up to manage it with the failover cluster manager. But if I wanted to basically add in all servers, add servers, I need to be able to find that new guy, which is the ADATUM file server. He's a computer account. Add him in. Now that he's available, I'll connect up to him, see he's online, see he's happy. And now under file services, under shares, I can now say make a new file share. And I want to say, you know what, just make a quick file share, make it available. Again, advanced means you're going to have things open all the time, application specific or not. I'm just going to say quick. And it shows the ADATUM FS file share is available, and it's a clustered system, currently being owned by number 4. And I want to say, go ahead and make it make the file share, make it available to me. And I'm going to call this guy docs, hit next. He's going to go off and ask me, do you want to make it available for continuous availability? Sure. Do you want to allow caching or not? Here's my default permissions being applied to the share itself. Hit create, and it goes off and makes me that file share. So now that he's made, if I just simply go off and say ADA, oops, ADAD, how do I spell it again?
ADATUM.
Yeah. FS. There's that doc share. There's the files and folders. There's my drive. Here's some, I don't know, storage reports. Do I have anything? Nope. Come on, I gotta have something I can throw in there. Here, I go into Windows and choose.
Right click, new text document.
That's a very highly available one. Right? I don't know. Just choose something. Copy.
Copying system 32.
Just because it's
That's
there,
awesome.
Right? Just for something to do. Go up. Did you not turn off your
it
phone?
It is off.
You didn't turn off your
it
phone.
It is off.
That is so rude. ADATUMFS docs paste. File stuff is copying up there. It's off and doing stuff. Of course, I have to discover what all those different files are. There we go. So it's going on there. I can flip back here to my cluster manager. Here's my resource owned by number 4. I can simply say, you know what? Go ahead and move this guy to the next available node. And I can say lawn number 3. And it goes ahead, does the move, passes them over to number 3. and off he goes. Simple. Flip back the slides, my friends, and we shall be looking at wrapping this guy up so I can take some questions from the queue, potentially.
That's everything you just did is what used to take 10 days back 10 years ago.
Now I've been replaced by a wizard. Failover clustering management tasks, how to manage your nodes, how to manage your networks, permissions, configuring cluster quorum settings. Basically, those are all available through the cluster server manager, cluster failover manager tool. To be able to add in more nodes, remove nodes, and how to go in and handle quorum settings on the system. Now, when you're working with a cluster, you now have to realize that these basically are now both part of the same entity, and you have to go in and add in. You have to go in and basically add new nodes into your cluster. You can add up to 64 nodes into a single cluster. You can pause nodes, which basically means those resources are not going to be running that node anymore. You can move them off to someplace else. You can take them down for maintenance. You can also evict nodes if you have to replace the hardware and bring them back in again. Is one thing you should be aware of.
It's only if they don't pay the rent, though.
Yeah, it's only if they don't pay the rent and the CRF comes along. Considerations for some things you want to be aware of. Basically, you can identify different workloads to have preferred owners or different nodes that are going to be the primary guys to take responsibility for this. You can even set up multiple preferred owners if you wanted to. That basically allows you to choose when I have a failover situation and things come back again and I've got lots of different nodes looking after that overall cluster, where are those guys going to reside upon? You want to try to balance the workloads across all the different nodes in your cluster. You're also able to go in and set preferred owners, the ability to go and choose applications that can or cannot run, on those nodes because of conflicts. Ability to modify failover and failback settings to choose. That are going to be working for how they go with failovers and failbacks. The tools to monitor your clusters. The first thing, if you ever have a problem with the cluster, validation wizard. Go check the previous report. Go run it again. Warning before you run it again. It asks you specifically, do you want me to also run the storage tests, which will disconnect your storage? Not a good idea if it's a production environment and you've got to make sure that the availability is there because the nodes will basically lose access to it. So you want to be aware of that, and they give you a special checkbox to say don't do the storage stuff. You can also pull up your previously formatted cluster report like I just mentioned there. Perfmon, obviously, and Reliability Monitor to see what's going on. That's standard troubleshooting stuff. Same thing with Event Viewer and even TraceRT. Backing up and restoring failover clusters, when you're doing a backup system state and backing up with the cluster itself, similar to how you've got a multi-master environment with Active Directory, you can choose to restore a non-authoritative restore, which basically restores the single node only for its configuration settings, or you can do an authoritative restore, which basically restores the entire cluster and all of its nodes across the back to make sure everything's all happy again. So be aware of that. You really want to make sure that server backup obviously is installed to be able to do this, or you have a third-party backup utility that supports volume shadow copy. Third-party tools generally great for being able to work with clusters, and you make sure that you're doing system state backups. This is common stuff.
I've seen authoritative and non-authoritative, and I thought we were suddenly on the AD land.
No, AD's afterwards. AD's after lunch.
Yeah.
After our long break. Troubleshooting, validation cluster wizard, as I mentioned. Review your storage configuration in case things have changed. Check to see if anyone's changed the cables recently. That's why it's good to label the cables to make sure.
It's not as much fun, though.
I know. And then also check your groups and your resource failure to see if anything's gone wrong. The one thing I wanted to end off with here was cluster updating. So this is actually, there is no demo for this, but I'm going to show you what I did last night. So I'm just going to go in here, go back to this guy. Okay, yes, here. So this is my, just to show you here, the failover to node number 3 worked fine for that file server to be able to do the stuff. If I go back here to my actual real cluster that's back there, I've already showed you my validation report. The cluster we're updating is new. For the first time you bring it up, you basically have to configure it. You can see here that I actually had a partial failure going on last night with one of my nodes. And I'm able to say the log of the updates in progress. There are none right now. I'm able to go in and configure cluster updating options. It's a wizard interface that quite simply will go through and say, hey, this is going to help you configure how to do self-updating. You have automatic updates in Windows Update for your servers that can take place, and then you can choose if they happen at certain times of the week or not. And you know, generally, you don't want to have this happening automatically on your servers because in the past, you would have to manually move the workloads off the node, do the update on that box, and then move those resources back in again. and then move them off of the second box, do the updates, and come back in again. This guy does it all. It's awesome. This wizard is awesome. It's great. I'm going to say, is enable for self-updating, disable or remove it, the role itself. I'm going to say enable it. And you set the schedule for when it's going to take place, time and day. Notice the default is actually the third Tuesday of the month, not the second one. So it basically gives you a week to make sure things are good if you've done your testing. And then you have the run options. And this is really cool. Basically, you can decide, hey, if it takes longer than half an hour to do the patches, stop what you're doing. I can't do this. If it warned me after 20 minutes with a notification that something's gone wrong, how many retries are you going to be able to do on that box before giving up? So lots of granular control of what the notification parameters are like in case things fail. Because imagine, you got a 64-node cluster, and node number 35 goes belly up. Once it's gone belly up, what do you do? Do you roll back all of them to be able to work on it the next time around? That's an option you can actually put in. You can even do scripts that run before and after those updates if you wanted to. And then you can choose, are you going to be using a Windows Update plugin as your main source, or are you going to be using a local file share with hotfixes in it, or possible settings and parameters for other options, basically. I'm just using the Windows Update plugin. Go ahead and review the Windows Update policy statements. Yeah, I already reviewed it. Here's my standard recommendations where it is. Hit apply, and even gives you the command line to run from PowerShell perspective what's going on. I'm hitting cancel because I'm borrowing this cluster.
Mm-hmm.
And I did one last night. And the reason why it says partially failed is I actually watched it start last night at 11:16. And it basically ended the last time it checked in at 11:47. The nodes went ahead and said, okay, I'm clean, there's no workloads on me, I'm going to go off and check for updates, there's updates to apply, I'm going to apply them. The apply's done, I'm going to reboot, come back up again, join the cluster back up again, I'm good. Okay, good, move the stuff over. You actually saw all my workloads of machines migrate over to the other node, and then the other guy went and checked for updates, got the updates, applied them, did the reboot, and then basically he came back up again, but he didn't, for some reason, I don't know, bug or something, for this particular implementation.
It's not a bug, it's a feature.
It went ahead and basically didn't fail back. The stuff stayed on the inside. That's why it says partially failed. So if I wanted to, I could say go ahead and apply them immediately, and I can just literally go through the exact same quick little wizard that I did before, and it's going to run it in the background. And what you're going to see here is the progress of everybody going up to take a look at what's going on. It's going to scan for new updates. It's going to talk to Windows Update. It's going to go off and basically coordinate moving stuff on and off the system if it has to, and then go ahead and do the update. And we could continue to do all of our labs and everything without any problems because those workloads are going to move over and come back. Very, very cool stuff for cluster updating. I think I'm out of time, but I've got maybe just one last topic I want to talk about, which is simply the ability to have a multi-site cluster, which is available in 2012. Basically, that you can actually have your nodes in different sites. You can do this also in 2008R2. Simply make sure you have extra fast connectivity between those individual sites. And then you identify, the main thing is how to be able to replicate your data to the other side. So it's important to be aware of that. It's now possible, and it's good to go. So, my friend, last comments or questions that we're out of here so we can wrap this one up?
That's it, man. We're over.
We're good?
We're good.
Okay, man. Well, that was the whirlwind view of
clustering
high availability.
In an hour.
Clustering in an hour. Regularly used to be 5-day course.
10-day course.
10-day course. Now down to 50 minutes. We'll be right back after the break.